Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to the Corbett Report. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com here in February of 2025 with another edition of Solutions Watch. And my purpose here on this edition of Solutions Watch is twofold. The first of which is pretty simple. I just want to get today's guest on your radar, if he is not yet already, because I think this guest resonates with a lot of the work that I'm doing here at Solutions Watch. And secondarily, we're going to be addressing a very specific issue that I know is of concern to, well, most of my audience, if not all. And if it isn't all, it should be all, because it is an incredibly concerning topic, specifically that of digital ID, the coming digital ID grid, and what we can and should be doing about it. Very heady questions, but first, let's bring him on the program. It is his first time, sorry, the D program. It is his first time on Solutions Watch or on the Corbett Report generally. So please welcome Gabriel of the Libra Solutions Network. And you can find him at LibraSolutions.network or his Substack, LibraSolutionsNetwork.substack.com. Don't worry, those links will be in the show notes. Gabriel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. And that's a huge compliment, and it means a great deal to be here. And I'm really excited to dig deep into what we're talking about here.
As am I. As I say, it's a big and important topic. But before we get into that, since this is your first time on the Corbett Report, why don't we just introduce you to the audience? Your name is Gabriel, or at least that's the name you post under, and you are at Libra Solutions Network. Tell us about the Libra Solutions Network, what it is, how it came about, why you're doing this work in the first place.
So my passion is technology. You know, many people kind of want to go low tech, like your recent Solutions Watch episode. But the thing is that actually, to be a little spicy about this, I read Ted Kaczynski's manifesto pretty young. I've always been incredibly curious. I mean, that's probably what led me here. But the thing is that I was very upset at his declaration that technology would always lead to tyranny. And so I had this idea in the back of my mind that I wanted to figure out how to prove him wrong fundamentally. Now that's a really ambitious goal, but that's kind of like the torch guiding the mission on some level. And the thing is like, I'm a young Canadian, and many people are probably quite aware of the chaos Canada is currently and has been in for quite some time. And to me, you know, this information landscape, I had always felt was, it's the corporation's fault. Fundamentally, we have these big tech giants that are running algorithms that do decide what content we see. And I'm very passionate about ways to go around that. And so in my own journey, I did what I could to disconnect from it, but I realized just freeing myself didn't really accomplish much. Yes, I was having a more, you know, down-to-earth understanding of some of these issues, but then when I would talk to other people, there was no way to bridge that gap. I had already gone too deep in some ways. And so what started this journey was when I was getting involved in local COVID resistance groups in person, I realized that the knowledge gap was so great, I probably needed to start writing these ideas down to share what I understood. You know, we were doing things where we would have nightly calls and I would give presentations, but it's like, really, I'm like, well, if I'm doing the work anyways, I may as well share it. And that was a big part of my, you know, growth in this entire process, because this was something I really just started because I was in a very dark place during the COVID years and just wanted to do something, because I spent, honestly, all of 2020 guilty. I'm like, what am I doing to oppose this? And to be blunt, I couldn't do much. And that was the thing that really disheartened me. And so it's really great to add clarity, because I've had, I guess, axes to grind this entire time. Digital technology is my focus. I'm not ignorant of other agendas. It's just the thing I feel like I have a place in the conversation to add fine details, as I like to call them.
Excellent. Well, yes, for people who do start exploring your work, and I hope they will at least check out your Substack and your website from this conversation, I think they will find that you have addressed a lot of these issues in some degree of technical detail, but also in ways that I think are friendly to the less technically inclined as well, which is an important part of all of this, because there seems to be a stratification of conversations that goes on in this particular space, talking about technological, digital solutions and or problems, is that it can be on an extremely technical level that only other tech nerds will be able to understand and appreciate, or it can be on the dumbed down level to the point where a lot of the information gets diluted. And I find that you strike a good balance between that in a lot of your posts. So
thank you.
I'll leave it up to the audience to judge for themselves. I hope they will check out your work. But let's talk about one specific post that you made recently that, as you confessed to off air there, it's a bit of an angry rant and not your usual style. But as I said to you earlier, I think this is an important topic that clearly is touching some sort of button with people, and I want to explore that because clearly it is an important subject. What am I talking about? I'm talking about the encroachment of the digital ID into our lives, which in some to some extent, I think we could argue, is already here to some extent. And so maybe there is not some magical threshold that we have to step over to reach that, but that might be part of this discussion. The post in question is called Internet Badasses Aren't Going to Stop Digital ID, which is a provocative enough title and a provocative rant that follows. Let's talk about what this is in response to and where this post came from.
So I'll admit one of the things that came to mind is, like, this is not the first time I've seen someone discuss digital ID. I had covered the topic myself in the past, and I felt like there was, you know, many knowledge gaps that I felt were important to kind of broach. And one of the big ones was that we had just gone through, you know, COVID, the whole pandemonium, whatever we want to call it. And the fact of the matter is that I think there's a lot of lessons that need to be learned. I've certainly learned a great deal, and I've been trying to, you know, share at least my own personal perspective on this. And one of the things I wrote maybe a couple of years back was that I was incredibly frustrated at how this whole activism process seemed to work. Now, I'm new at this, so I don't have, like, an authoritative position to speak on this, but at least in my perspective, when I was talking to people on the ground, they were people who are not, you know, setting up their entire life for sovereignty. You know, these are not probably even regular corporate, you know, viewers. These are people who really just kind of were thrown into this mess immediately. And where was the support structure? Now, to be fair, I'm in Ottawa. Ottawa is kind of like the belly of the beast when it comes to this stuff. And I actually just interviewed the owner of a gym that resisted lockdown. And I thought that was a great example to look at. And the thing is one of the things I've learned throughout this time is that there are communities that are prepared to resist, and there are communities that aren't, regardless of their overall political and social environment. And to me, the things I think that really builds into that is how much you want to be independent. Because as a Canadian, so much of stuff is, like, directly related to government, funded by government, or it's a company that's all its contracts are from government. And those tendrils reach down. And so I think there are many different important things which we can touch on to proactively work on this, but there is an acknowledgement that I think needs to be made that that's not a fixed thing. If your city currently isn't ready to resist, there's many things that can be done, even if your jurisdiction, you know, is kind of screwed. Like, to be honest, I spent most of 2020 in, you know, terror, thinking, oh, I'm in Ottawa, there's no hope. And truthfully, I'm out on the other end of that, but the fact of the matter is, there's a great deal that can be done, and I have been so humbled by the, you know, support and kindness I've encountered with people that really has made a huge difference. But what really animated this post was that I have seen some of these people up close. I've seen people who've really, you know, had some either trauma or, you know, just stress of the situation they're in. You know, they have three kids and they just got rid of their job, or they're old and none of their kids are talking to them because their kids aren't, you know, on the same side. And, like, that's a really tragic situation. And so I was in this group, Glorious and Free, I'm going to name drop it, but, like, I actually angrily left kind of in the same way I left the note, because I'm like, if we can't function as a support group for people with really, you know, basic and understandable problems, how are we going to actually advance liberty and actually create the ideal of a resilient community can withstand these objectives? And so that was the disconnect that really drove this post, in the sense that, like, there are many people when you say, hey, we need to, like, work on, you know, supporting each other. And that's a trigger word, because it's like, oh, you're a dirty collectivist now. And to me, you know, collectivism is we acknowledge a common good, therefore we can do this to you. But acknowledging a common good and wanting to work together isn't a bad thing in my mind. And that's kind of what I'm trying to, like, push towards in this idea. And so I got a lot of pushback from people when I made a comment on a larger Substack where I was talking about how, what is the point? And I worded it, you know, maybe I'd word it differently now, but I said, there's no point telling people to resist at any cost if you're not going to be that support system. You're kind of just signing up people to fail. And to me, that drove a lot of frustration, because I'm like, well, look, if we're just signing up people to be in our army for our political movements, what are we doing to kind of arm that army? And that's, like, I think a more complicated discussion, because I think we should want something more than just an army that follows our orders. I think we should recognize that we're people and we can contribute, we can work together. And the responses I got back from people were basically, look, okay, if you're just not ready for this, buddy. And I told people, like, you don't know who you're talking to if you're saying that, because look, I refused the shot. I, you know, got fired over it. I made them fire me. You know, it was Canadian Blood Services. And I felt a lot of pride working at that job. That, you know, as a young millennial working at an institution that is, you know, well regarded in the community, I kind of felt like, wow, I'm really making a difference. And having to give that up and basically be a burden on the people around me for quite some time. Now, part of that has to do with my situation. I'm pretty heavy. If I was more able-bodied, I probably would have been able to find another income quite quickly. I actually knew a place that I could have gone to. And so the thing is that to me, that was the thing that taught me I had many mistakes I needed to correct in my own life. And I've actually done that. I've lost 100 pounds already in the last half a year. And that's the thing that I'm really kind of laser focused on right now. Is there stuff we can do now that can make a difference in the future?
Excellent. Well, okay, let's get into the details of this. So the post is specifically around a comment that you left in response to a Mike Eden post on The Hill to Die On, in which he was making the argument against drawing that line in the sand, essentially, and not refusing to comply with the digital ID, which, to be clear, I think both you and I are in agreement with that. However, I think there are more details to be filled in. And in your response to that, you wrote a comment, telling people to refuse digital ID is pointless in a scenario where there's no support structure for people who refuse. Canada, UK, Australia all had large amounts of people lose employment and be put into very difficult situations over this scamdemic, I assume. If there's one lesson that many people have learned, it is that opposing these mass agendas is often too costly to bear. How free is somebody without an income, digital ID notwithstanding? It seems that people are a lot more interested in pontificating about what they know and can see, rather than actually building support structures to resist tyranny. This is understandable considering how much the system discourages actually building meaningful connections. The comment goes on from there. Please do read the entire thing in your free time. But I think it. What is most interesting to me is that type of response and feedback that you got to this comment. People pushing back on you as if you're not working in the same direction here. People getting triggered by that idea that we need to be developing community support structures in advance, regardless of when and if there is some magical line in the sand. Here is the digital ID. Take this mark in your forehead and your arm or whatever. Regardless of that, there needs to be a support structure in place, which is essentially, I think, something that I've been stressing and hammering home in Solutions Watch time after time. It is about building community, finding like-minded people that you can work with together, finding support structures. I'm a little bit baffled as to why people would be so angry about this. So let's start exploring some of the feedback and the pushback you got on this concept.
Well, the one that really stood out to me actually was people saying that I was the reason why, you know, vaccines were being pushed on people and it was my lack of fortitude, you know, whatever. And having gone through what I've gone through, I didn't really feel a need to justify myself to them, but I did feel a need to kind of push back and say, you don't know who you're talking to, because a lot of people kind of make assumptions about what people are believing or what they've done based off how they word something. And that was the other feedback I got, is, oh, that I was a collectivist, that I was, you know, part of the tyranny. And the other interesting one was that I was destined to hell because of revelations. Now, to be clear, I'm raised Catholic. I believe in God, and, you know, I put in my religious exemption for the COVID vaccines that I was like, or injections, whatever, that I said, if I submit to this, I am giving them ownership of my body, which is at least a violation of the first commandment. Like, if you actually, you know, hold these things. But I also worded, and at the risk of, if you'll humor me with this, I put in that exemption request, which was denied. But what I said was, this to me reeks of a prefigurement for the mark. Now, maybe that's a silly point to make, but what the point I was trying to make there is that there are many spiritual hazards to your immortal soul rather than a single one at a single point. And so to me, I'm like, well, if it smells like it, maybe you should still resist. However, I think if it is our calling to resist this, we have obligations to not just be like, oh, I took it, I'm fine. I didn't take it, I'm fine. We have an obligation to kind of support and help other people on that journey, because what's it all for? Like, it rubs me the wrong way. And to me, it was hard because, like, the feedback was harsh. And I had kind of, like, just woken up to notifications like crazy. I kind of, like, wrote it before I went to sleep, woke up, and it was crazy. And a lot of it is, like, people, like, I got some interesting responses where people are saying, it's got to be every man for himself. And I'm like, well, that's a problem, you know? It's like, it doesn't have to be.
You know, that is such a good point. Okay, there are two different threads here that I want to explore, one of which is a point that you've made that I think is important, that people who are simply waiting for some magical line in the sand moment where the government says, this is the digital ID, you must accept it, or you will be cast out, or whatever. People waiting for that heroic moment where they can refuse are probably going to get swept up in this one way or another, because as you say later on in your comment, it also helps to be clear that digital ID isn't just a single thing. If Elon Musk truly does turn X into the everything app, like he has stated on record he wants to do, for those who don't know, then all the people waiting to refuse a government digital ID while they've already KYC'd on X with Authentix and other services that are known to be giving your information to the Israeli government, etc., will have been tricked into the same thing. Pardon the angry rant, but this has been well understood for years, and there's been little to no meaningful movement on this front. That's an important point to raise. People waiting for the line in the sand moment may not realize they've already crossed that line way back there because it wasn't presented to them in a way that they understood. Let's talk about the bigger question of digital ID and what it even is.
So what I feel like I should probably say here is that as a techie, I've been listening to the other side talk about this, you know, the actual cybersecurity professionals interested in digital ID, because a book I got, Cybersecurity First Principles, A Reboot and Strategies and Tactics, I read through that, and this is like the cybersecurity 101 training to anyone entering this field. And digital ID is not just something they want. It's a fundamental pillar of a strategy called Zero Trust that is, first of all, it was bigly embraced in the Biden administration, but has continued on to the Trump administration. This is not an agenda that's partisan. Both, you know, sides are kind of going in this direction. And what Zero Trust is trying to accomplish, in my mind, is that big tech and consolidating all our digital lives into a giant mainframe increases the risks. If everybody has their own little system here and there, the risk isn't going to go catastrophic if China hacks it or whatever, which actually already happened to the wiretap system. So there's concern here. So what Zero Trust is it's a cybersecurity framework to monitor how people interact within these systems at the person and, well, database record level. And that's a really important implementation here because it doesn't just presume digital ID, it is a reason to put it in. And this is where I personally believe that some serious cybersecurity upgrades have been kind of left to the wayside to create the pretext that we need this, because we're hearing about a new data breach every week, every month, you know, dozens of them, huge amounts. And now there's going to be this problem reaction solution model where it's like, oh, we got these data breaches. People are worried about them and their privacy. So just trust us. We're going to put it all under our control. And what this has to do with the problem and the solutions here fundamentally is that if we continue down this road of letting big tech run everything by letting them centralize our entire digital landscape under their control, all that's going to do is require them to use these systems to do their own risk management. They're not going to relent just because we don't want it. And that's why I find, you know, my superpower fundamentally when it comes to my journey here is I've been listening to not just people I disagree with, but even people who like probably hate my guts, but I can still find them worth learning from because it has to do with the fact that you can't just be in your own silo of fear and worry, which I've been there, believe me. You have to actually understand these issues at a deeper level. And that's why I try to share what I've kind of learned. And the cybersecurity fight is huge because they are going to tell us that if we don't want the digital ID or we refuse to use it, we are wanting the data breaches. We are responsible. You know, I believe on some level that the cyber pandemic is already here. The breaches are happening. The institutions are really rallying the troops to correct these issues. But all it is risk management for these giant enterprises that already have too much control over our lives. And it's getting worse because now there's a big health push with AI, you know, Project Stargate and, you know, the big wearables push right now. Like, to me, it's very insidious.
It is extremely insidious, and I think the incrementalism is something that people might not understand, because what is that magical line? Where does that occur? When they announce that suddenly your driver's license is now a digital-only entity, is that the line in the sand? And what do you do about that? And what kind of, as you say, what kind of support structure exists to help you in your resistance towards that? Let alone, is there anything that's possible within the confines of the system as it exists to adequately reject that? And would that actually make a difference to the system? These are important questions that get lost in the internet badassery, which is, it's a good way of putting it, because there certainly is a sort of chest thumping, not to put too fine on a point on it, dick measuring contest that goes on in comment sections, etc., where I am the most purest person who ever exists, and I only access information on some laptop that I keep in a Faraday cage 99% of the time. That's the only reason I'm here typing this to you, and other tall tales that people tell online to virtue signal how wonderfully, amazingly non-digital they are, even as they are existing in the cyberspace already. So clearly there's, I think there is a certain posturing that goes on in these types of comments, and I suppose that might be part of the other thing, the thread that I want to address, the resistance that people have to the suggestion that it might not be every man for himself, and the ideal situation may not be to live in a cabin out in the woods, because you raised the specter of Uncle Ted, hardy har har, as some corners of the internet and have now termed him, as if he's, you know, oh, this is what they don't want you to read. This is the cool stuff. He saw what was coming, man. And so to some extent, I know there's, you know, meme lord kind of edgy, humorous, ironic take to it, but there is a veneration of Ted Kaczynski in that line of thinking that is going on right now that is dangerous, because it does lead to the suggestion that the only way to do it is living off of bugs and rainwater in the woods by yourself. And, oh, by the way, yeah, killing and, you know, sending bombs to people and things to prove your point is a good way of doing things. I reject that completely and totally. But the question really is, okay, great, yes, support structures should exist, people should be resisting this, but how? What does that look like? What are some concrete steps people can be taking right now to start extracting themselves, or at least setting up firewalls around themselves so that they do not enter into this digital ID prison?
I mean, I would definitely, as the nature of my work, I would push, you know, any degree of digital disconnect you can have, because I believe the worst part of the digital ID is its ability to be gating various aspects of life. And so what's important is that you are not relying on, you know, your business, your life, your social interactions. If that is all taking place digitally, you know, I really love how you talked about this in the media matrix, where it's like, are we already in it? And that's a serious question people need to ask themselves, because I had to learn this kind of the hard way. You know, throughout COVID, I was very alone, and, you know, I only had myself and my other half kind of freaking out about this. And I was luckier than others, which is why I do feel indebted to some people during this process. And I do feel there's a real, you know, challenge here. And so to me, I would say the first thing, even before you address the digital stuff, is think of who you're fighting for. Like, as if it's just yourself, I'm not going to lie, the bad guys pay better. Like, let's be fundamental here. You know, if it's just about your own individual liberty and you're ready to, you know, comply your way into getting it, that's an effective strategy. I'm not saying I'd go that road, and I'm not encouraging anyone to take it. But if it's just about yourself, that's probably going to be the road you'll take. And so to me, it has more to do with what are you trying to work towards. Ideally, you don't just want liberty for yourself, but people around you, or even humanity at large. Wherever you draw the line, I think it's so important to use that as the fuel to get you to connect to others, because that's kind of where I've been. You know, I've signed up at a local gym with a very, you know, great personal trainer who's been helping me really achieve these goals. But like, so many people there are so encouraging and great, and I can have the kind of conversations I wish I could have had in 2020. And this is kind of the problem, where everybody's stuck in this like me mindset, by which I'm honestly convinced is some kind of technocrat brainwashing on some point. If we are all so preyed on that we can't think of anything but ourselves, that's going to make it harder to make any of these proactive steps. And so a big part of that to me is humanizing yourself and other people, because other people are going to have flaws. They're not going to be that person with everything put together. They're not going to be that person who knows all the lingo or can even put it into practice right away. A lot of the changes I want to make in myself are taking time, and the big heavy stuff is also going to take time with other people. And so this is where there's kind of this other dirty secret in this entire discussion, where when I join these communities and talk to people, you know, when I was doing the local meetups, I was a rarity because I was a younger person, a younger man in these groups. And we have to ask ourselves why. And to be blunt, I think it's two factors. Like, a lot of people just want to say the young are brainwashed. And I think that's certainly true to a degree. Like, I'm not going to deny that many people of my generation do see these things exactly the way the government tells them. But on the other hand, I'm also kind of like, well, what on-ramps do we have for these people? If they come to us and say, hey, I want to learn how to contribute, and we tell them, man, just go to the woods and never talk to anyone, well, have we really helped them? Maybe, you know, the technocracy of being part of the system does look better than the deal being offered. And it's hard. It's a hard journey. You know, many people are struggling with the economy as it exists right now. And then, like, these are serious issues. And so to me, like, I would also say, steal good ideas from the left. You know, actually, I was watching Derek Broz's conference at the Greater Reset, and he was talking about how, you know, you can learn some decent ideas from progressives, and you don't have to take, you know, their politics, you don't have to take their, or even their morality or whatever your issue with them. You can take a lot of genuinely great ideas. And, you know, to me, where this came into practice was I discovered the Fediverse, and this is a, you know, decentralized social media platform where people can host their own servers and build their own online communities. It's not in real life, but it still creates an independent foothold in cyberspace. And guess what? It's very far left dominated. You're not going to be on there without some interaction. And I think in some ways it's a good thing. You shouldn't be siloing yourself politically. And the other thing, which we kind of touched on earlier, is I would say, you know, recognize and refuse, because it's one thing to refuse the government digital ID, but we mentioned there are many roads to that same destination. And I'm, to be blunt, also concerned about how the cryptocurrency industry is also building many of these things, you know, because there is this big push. You know, WorldCoin is probably a perfect example. Now, WorldCoin isn't decentralized, but it is a crypto, you know, asset that has this hierarchical structure that does fundamentally amount to the same thing. And when you think about it, WorldCoin has already been used around the world to do what people are already afraid of. Like you say, there are aspects in which this line has already been crossed. And that's, you know, to me, the guiding post of my work, where it's like, we need to decentralize not just our social media apps. We don't just need to decentralize our, you know, messengers or whatever we want to use. It's not a install a new app and we fixed everything. We need to seriously think about the local digital infrastructure. Because one of the things I'm very concerned about, especially when it comes to Elon Musk, is Starlink is a very great product for somebody to use convenience wise, but if it outcompetes all the local ISPs, which is something that's a big problem in developing regions right now, but let's be honest, can't happen to rural places, then Musk is in charge of your internet connection. And that, if that's your access to the wider world, that's a huge problem. And so to me, decentralization is not just about tokenization and finding a new system. It's about really going back to the brass, you know, levels of the fundamental reality. Where are the fiber cables? What are we building? How are businesses getting their materials? How is that all working? Like right now, especially as Canadians, I think there are a lot of serious questions being asked thanks to the tariffs that have just started about, like, oh, are we buying local and these kinds of things? And yeah, that message is out there, but that's probably worth, you know, leveraging to get these discussions going, because we need to have these discussions about how to actually decentralize not just our own lives, not just our online footprint, but also the industries we want to be a part of. Because to me, this consolidation of the tech space and letting it run roughshod over the rest of the world is the consolidation of everything and is the prison we're trying to fight.
Exactly right. You know, that brings up, I mean, for example, just thinking about the problem, rural places with spotty internet, well, let's go with Starlink. What are the other choices? And of course, I immediately start thinking, well, how about if we had some sort of, you know, regional or even national mesh network system? But again, that technological idea is predicated on community, and it's predicated on a support structure of people coming together with the motivation, the understanding of why this is important, why they should be committing time and resources to it, what's in it for them. Because another important point that you raise, the mindset of it's every man for himself, and I'm not responsible for other people. Who cares? They can go suffer. That is exactly why the positions of elite power in the financial and corporate and technological oligarchy are populated by an overrepresented amount of sociopaths and psychopaths. Because, as you say, if it is every man for himself and, you know, who cares what anyone else gets, the best deal you could take if you're a smart and clued in person is to go work for the they, them, those, because they pay better. Yep, that's the calculus. And if that is your calculus, that's ultimately what you'll end up doing. So I think it is important to combat and confront that mindset, because, as you say, it leads in some dark directions. And perhaps I have more to say about that. But before I do, let's get into the specifics from your post about the do's and don'ts, the do's and two avoids. So I'll just read through them and then we'll discuss as needed. So, for example, do reintegrate yourself into your local community, getting to know your neighbors, using cash and local currencies. Building support groups. Yikes. Sorry. supporting and expanding independent local businesses. Understanding that digital ID is a system, not an implementation. There are both public and private sources of digital ID. Consider them both. Care about results. Do you know how dependent your local economy is on government and BlackRock? Do you know how many people have already opted in with or without knowing? And then there are some don'ts, or to avoids, let's call them. Don't dehumanize the compilers. I think you've touched on that. Don't lecture people on the spiritual importance. Don't go into the fight alone, and don't forget other fights. A lot of important tips in there. Anything you'd like to specifically address in greater detail?
Specifically, I will say don't dehumanize the compilers. I'll have to fix that. Is a really important one, because I have this post on my personal website called Don't Turn on the Flock. And it's by a guy who at the time I believe was vaccine injured. And he was responding to something Andrew Tate said about, oh, they're just slave-minded sheeple wearing masks. And he kind of explained that those of us who understand the agenda, understand what's going on, arguably, we have more responsibility than those who kind of don't see it. If we are gifted with some kind of knowledge that gives us an advantage over other people, how are we choosing to use it? And he points out how you can use it for evil just like you can use it for good. It's really an open question on how much, you know, those politicians and MPs who are listening to our concerns and just ignoring them, are you really sure they're not seeing the same things we're seeing? I don't think so. And so I do think when it comes to, like, how are we actually fighting for other people, you do need some animating purpose that involves caring about other people. And that includes the people who are kind of working against you. And I think, you know, another book I should probably mention is I read Prometheus Rising by, what's his name, Robert Anton Wilson. And it's kind of a tough treatise on brainwashing. But to me, if you fully recognize the full spectrum assault that's on people, you kind of have to cut them a little slack, in my opinion, because, you know, when they shock people with fear, their rational circuits don't work. I know mine certainly weren't working when I was out of my mind in 2020, believe me. And I was just afraid of what the government might do. Like, let's be real. It's like there's a fear can come from any direction. And so to me, this is so important to think about, is how do we recognize the brainwashing in a way that we can actually proactively counteract? We can't unbrainwash every single person out there, but it's a fact of the life that we exist in. And so how do we navigate around that? And I would say, as a Canadian, with the tariffs going on and people wanting to talk about buying local, now is a great time to think about decentralizing our economy, because I think the worst case scenario is we all just ship back and say, oh, they're going to do it for us. And then suddenly it's Trudeau's cronies or whoever's in charge are reshaping the economy, because they will have that power. And so it is very applicable to the fights that are going on now, but it's also very applicable to the bigger picture.
Excellent. Well, there are many things to discuss around this. I'm sure we could talk about it for hours. But before we wrap up on this, I certainly hope people will go and at least read your post on this for the details of what you're talking about. But let me do my best to try to steel man or play devil's advocate for the other side of this argument, because I certainly can understand on the human level. I have known people who have been in this fight in various ways and doing their best to get word out about this information for decades, who were very demoralized by what happened during the scamdemic, and watching friends and family and others who had been dismissing them for year after year after year as crazy conspiracy theorists, and why are you telling me all this stuff, and you should be locked down, you should be wearing a mask, you're a bad person, people being disowned by their families, etc., for the having the gall to disagree with them on this subject. And I've known people who have essentially checked out or on the way to checking out. I don't care anymore. I've tried for years and years and years to wake people up on these issues, and they've only ever scorned me. And now, mask off, they've shown me what they will do in the case of emergency. Why should I bother creating support structures for these people? Why shouldn't I get what I can for myself? Perhaps this is a question that's above either of our pay grades, but what would you say to that mindset?
I will say, to be blunt, I felt it. Like, I'm sure one could understand from the examples I've given, this is something that is very fresh in mind. And to me, a lot of it came from the fact that this is a difficult thing to do, you know, to kind of make it personal with my weight loss journey. You know, I was 570 pounds above and I could barely walk. I was limping to move around, and it's not an easy thing to turn around. And it's crazy how with a really tiny bit of support, and, you know, even for people who are trying to get the word out, maybe we do need to support the people who have been tirelessly, you know, working to shine a light on what matters. Because I think, like, to me anyways, a thank you email probably means a lot more than people would think. You know, it's just a small, simple gesture that really goes a long way. But for me, you know, so many people believe severe obesity is unchangeable. You give up on those people. They're not going to get better. They don't have the willpower. And believe me, it's hard to turn that situation around. I will never tell anyone it's easy. However, with less support and less understanding than you think, you can absolutely bring people out of situations that are way worse than people think are recoverable. Like, I'm very lucky that I do have a good support system and it is working for me. And that's why, you know, I'm kind of ringing the bell on this issue. But the truth and the fundamental thing is that it really has radicalized me, because I've realized if this situation that I'm in, you know, 570 pounds, can barely walk, is being turned around so effectively. I squatted over 100 pounds on top of my body weight the other week. You know, these are big, significant changes, and it doesn't take as much as you'd think. And so to me, if you generalize that to the wider discussion of what can we do for our communities and our neighbors, it takes a lot less than you think. You don't have to sacrifice everything for people you don't know or people who don't understand what's going on. Just really trying to get that ball rolling makes way bigger a difference than you could imagine. And that's really what I'm trying to say. I'm not going to promise it'll be perfect or that we'll be in a utopia, but I think things can improve a heck of a lot with a little bit of effort.
You know, that that response resonates with me on a number of levels, one of which is that I was recently squatting less than my body weight and my back almost gave out. So I am particularly attuned to that at the moment, just old man problems. But secondarily, perhaps more importantly, it brings to mind the mentality of people who would make fun of an overweight person at a gym. Why would that is? I've never understood that. No, this is someone who has recognized a problem and is working to address it. Why would you not give that person support and encouragement, or at the very least, be neutral? Whatever they're doing, whatever for their own body, who cares? But people who would attack that are—that's the kind of mentality I just don't understand. And I suppose perhaps the reason why I don't. Not only do I not feel demotivated by the response from the scamdemic and the things that I've seen, I feel that this is actually perhaps the best time to be reaching out to people, because a lot of people who weren't thinking these ways or were on the fence are now actively starting to think about it, and they are looking to people who have been doing this for a long time and maybe reaching out and maybe thinking about it. And if you respond with, who cares, I don't care about you, you laughed at me, now go get yours, you sucker. If that's the response, do you think they're going to want to listen to reality at that point? So for me, I guess I would say, personally, I have never felt it is my responsibility to convince anyone of anything. No, you have to believe me. No, you have to do it this way. I am just putting information out to the world, and if people take it on board, great. And if they don't, well, that's their decision, and I'm not going to, you know, counteract their sovereignty in order to make it so in their life. And because that's my attitude, I'm just throwing stuff out there, and where there's fertile soil, seeds will flower. Then it doesn't really bother me to a huge extent if people, if they take it on board, if they don't, whatever, that's their concern. I'm just doing what I can to get the word out there. So I feel less demotivated, because ultimately I know it's not my responsibility to be anyone's crutch or whatever. I'm just here doing what I can in the way that I can. And I would like to say, can I say this myself? High verbal intelligence. At any rate, I think I'm a good communicator, so that's the role that I've taken, and that's what I'm doing, and that's the way I see what I'm doing. So I think, yes, just being supportive of people who are looking for this information, I think goes an incredibly long way, and that's why I don't write off that whole internet badassery, you know, screw you guys, every man for himself. Yeah, it's an important subject, and I hope people take this seriously. I hope people will read through your post and read, for example, the commentary you've had with commenters in your Substack, back and forth, talking about this, and a nice moment of actually disagreeing with someone and then coming to a sort of conclusion. Well, okay, thank you. Thank you for explaining yourself, which is not something you see online very much. That's the level of discourse I would very, very much like to have some part in fostering out there in the greater world. So hats off to you for managing that. Before we wrap up on this topic, is there any points that you'd like to address that we haven't touched on yet?
I'm trying to think of something, but the thing is that I really think that everybody has their hobby horses. There is always one issue that is really important to me. You know, for me, it's tech. For other people, it'll be health. For other people, it'll be legal issues. We have to think about how to work together along those lines. Because to be honest, a big part of what's motivated me to keep writing is that I perceive that our movement, whatever we want to call it, the broader coalition of people against these measures, doesn't take tech very seriously. And I'm like, well, I could at least try talking about it. You know, that's one solution I have for this. And it's hard because, like, if there's one thing that's been a difficult lesson to learn throughout this entire time, is that one of the reasons it may be hard for people to connect in real life and do some of these things that are very important is that not everybody you're going to encounter is going to be for you. I was part of a local, you know, IRL activist group trying to do things, and it didn't work for me. In hindsight, I'd be like, find, you know, two or three great people and then dip out before anything gets too crazy. But the fact of the matter is that it's going to be hard. You will find people who are going to test your patience in this regard. And I think it is some degree of not over-investing in particular leads. It's important to recognize that there are people who are kind of preying on people who want to make a difference one way or another. And to me, it's been very kind of challenging to wrap my head around the fact that just because somebody's saying things you agree with, it doesn't mean they're, you know, really working in that interest. And the way I kind of think about it is like, do they walk the walk? You know, for instance, it's really nice to see you, you know, promoting RSS in a way to actually decentralize your connection to the internet and information and all this stuff, because algorithms are impacting your mind, whether you kind of notice it or not. I've certainly reflected on how it's affected me in certain ways. And so it's important to consider really just all the ways you can manipulate people who are trying to do good, because that's part of the equation. It is kind of tragic for me. And that's what makes me kind of angry when I see these things where some people are going as far as to profit off people worried about these concerns. And I'm going to be honest, it's a pretty easy grift to run. You just make a few tweets and buy, you know, the right engagement metrics or whatever. And, you know, people will lap it up. And that's why I think being in these, you know, wider circles, building trust is important, because those are the people that are going to steer people away from these, you know, dead ends fundamentally. You need somebody who they trust and can say, hey, is this a legit way of pushing back? Should I, you know, sign this newsletter? Should I buy this thing that's going to fix everything? You know, there's many different ways to this end goal. And so I think it's really important to consider there are nefarious factors out there. I don't deny that.
All right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, some very good points. And I'm sure we could continue exploring these and the issues that you bring up there for many hours. Hopefully we can have some more conversations in the future on other specific solutions and what have you. But at the very least, I hope that I have introduced yourself and your work to more of my audience. I hope they will at least check it out. On that note, when they do, when they start exploring not only your Substack, which I've mentioned, but also the LibreSolutions.network website, but also Gabe.rocks, which I understand is your personal website, where I will note that, for example, right there, right on the front page, you have a weight tracker documenting your fitness goals. That's excellent. And that's exactly part of that walking the walk. That, you know, he's talking the talk, but is he walking the walk and demonstrating that? Talk about why you are putting this out there in the public and why you are documenting this.
Well, the really simple answer is accountability. You know, it's one thing to plan to lose a lot of weight. It's a long journey from 570 to the target I want to hit is 15% body fat. That's going to take a long time. But the real reason why I wanted to talk about this publicly, fundamentally, is the fact that it's not an easy road. I've, you know, was motivated by many people showing videos of themselves. And it's usually a collage of like, they do a bunch of exercises. You know, it's like a guy's, you know, dancing or, you know, running on a treadmill. And that's great and wonderful. To me, those actually really did help me realize, hey, maybe I can do this too. but I do want to share the authentic progression. You know, going down from 500 to a healthy body weight is a long journey. And even just this last month in January, I shared some pretty tough moments and feelings that actually kind of shocked my mother when she saw it. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that, like, it is a tough thing to do. And I kind of do generalize it to this same journey. I read this book by Sumi Kim, a powerlifter. It's like how to become a tough mother effer, a mentally tough person. And it talks about this directly. It's like you have to have a long-term goal and do little things that build up to it. And I apply that to my work as well as my weight loss journey. And it's really helping me grow in ways I never thought possible. And doing it publicly, I get so much more kindness from internet strangers than I ever would have expected. One would assume that if you create a website that nobody, you know, links to and you have an RSS feed, nobody's going to reach out. I was doing this weird thing where I'd go on walks and record a vlog. Who wants to listen to a fat guy talk about his troubles losing weight? But apparently people will tune in over RSS, send an email, say, hey, I really love what you're doing and it's great. And we'll give some tips and some encouragement. And it's been absolutely humbling to think about there are people out there. You know, there is a free and open web beyond these social media platforms that can be so much better than what most people are dealing with.
Awesome. Well, that is truly good to hear. And as I say, I think you're right. This all, in a sense, is connected. Yes. What are you doing? The small steps that you do that can be challenging and there can be setbacks along the way, but can you keep at it? And will that transform your life in the long run? Well, that's something that you're finding out right there in real time and documenting for people to see, which I think is an important part of this, because it's one thing to do it for yourself. It's another thing to do it in a public setting where people can, in a sense, participate in that journey. And again, I think people fail to appreciate just how inspiring that can be, whether it's in weight loss or in prepping yourself for digital ID or absolutely anything else. Just seeing someone make a transformative journey can, I think, affect their mindset and really flip that switch of, oh, this is possible. It can be done. And I think that is, well, hats off to all the people out there who are doing it, yourself included. So I think we'll leave this conversation here for today. Gabriel, once again, can you throw out any and all relevant links that people should be following and to find your work?
Now the best place is I have gabe.rocks/links. That will be everything I'll link to one way or another. You can find my PeerTube instance. You can find my Fediverse accounts there. And the other cool thing that I've just started is I'm using an open source tool called Logsec to make knowledge graphs. And I'm sharing that publicly because it allows you to easily export it. And so that link is also there. And that way, when I write an article, I can share even more links. There's more context. You know, the research goes into it. I'm really loving that system and I'm excited to make that more useful over time.
Yeah, I did see the post on that. I'm looking forward to seeing how you develop that, because I think it could very much be a very interesting tool for people who are interested in open source investigation generally. But I think we'll leave this conversation here today. Gabriel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.